be harvesting that and optimizing that space with radishes and arugula and Asian greens. We haven't planted raspberries or blackberries, but if our listeners have blackberries and raspberries, yeah, it is time to cut the canes, mm-hmm, that have produced fruit already, to cut, prune them to the ground level, yeah, and the canes that are still strong, tie them up and make sure that there is put all together for the winter, because, mm-hmm, now we have to think those plants are perennials and they're not going to produce more flowers. They are going to lose their leaves, yeah, but they have to be protected for the winter.
Right.
So, yes, I'm trying to put the raspberries, preparing, yeah, them for the winter. And continue watering the garden and weeding.
Yeah.
Still, there are some plants that had some infested by pests, like aphids. So still are there. Mm-hmm. Slugs are coming. Still, there is one or two white butterflies going into the garden, laying, yeah, eggs, yeah, and the moment that we put our new crops, particularly radishes, I don't know why these plants, these butterflies, the larvae of butterflies love radishes, but, mm-hmm, yeah, somehow the radishes are the first crops to be eaten by the, yeah, these larvae. Let's keep becoming a good janitor and start slowly cleaning our garden, because once fall arrives, we should be aware that rainy days arrive, mm-hmm, cold days arrive, windy days arrive, and that is not the best environment to be in the garden. And if there is lots of things to move, lots of
work to be done,
and you're like, oh, we live for another week, and suddenly, yeah, it became a habitat for all the pests to stay over the winter. So, yeah, it's time to start making sure that our garden is slowly being cleaned up and disposing things like we don't need. For instance, pots, yeah, that we've been buying, all the seedlings that we're buying from the nurseries, all these pots are stored in there. Are we going to use? No, that has to be removed from, yeah, the garden. Yeah. So then we start thinking into the fall season, which is starting September, week, mm-hmm, 36. And then we have to identify which crops we'd like to grow and make sure that we have seeds.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a time to, if you don't have seeds, replace those. Visit your favorite place where you get your seeds, yeah, and start making sure that you have seeds for the fall to plant. We're in this transition period, mm-hmm, but we need to take it one step at a time. So when the rainy season arrives, we are not caught like, oh, no, I don't have seeds, or I should have planted before, because, yep, now there are 3-4 days in a day, mm-hmm, in a row it's raining and you cannot go and plant your, right, seeds. So, yeah.
So if we're going grabbing our seeds, are we starting to germinate them, or are these ones
put
them right into the soil?
Put right into the soil.
Yes. A little drill and,
yeah, okay. So it's called direct seeding.
Yeah.
And we put directly in the soil because the soil is still as warm.
Mm-hmm.
Warm. So it still is warm. So the seeds, if we add water, the seeds germinate in 7 days.
Right.
So, yeah, so we'll be very, very quick. And we don't have to worry about maintaining the seeds indoors. We have to water. You have to make sure that there is enough light, otherwise they go spindly and all that. Being outdoors, the soil is warm. We just need to make sure, mm-hmm, that there's water, and the seeds will germinate and we continue.
So this might be a really, really obvious question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So, as you say, the soil, it's sunny, it's warm out, the soil is warm.
Mm-hmm.
We can drop the seeds right in. But the reason we need to germinate them at the beginning of the season, because that's not the case, the soil is way too cold.
Correct, yeah.
And if we waited till the soil was warm enough to plant the seeds, we lose a bunch of growing season.
That's right. That's why we do indoor seeding, because the soil doesn't warm up until April.
Yeah.
In some cases, until May, so it depends where you are. And more or less, this temperature of the soil is 1 degree colder than the air temperature.
Mm-hmm.
So if the air temperature in spring is around 10 degrees,
yeah,
your soil is around 8 or 9 degrees. It's very cold.
Yeah.
So seeds won't germinate. So seeds need around at least 12 degrees Celsius to germinate.
Yeah.
So that's why we had to push a bit until the night temperature is above 12 degrees. So the soil will be around 10 degrees, 11 degrees. So
right.
Yeah.
But now, of course, everything's warmer, so we can go straight into the soil.
Yes. So that's what yeah, that's the seed requirement. The other thing is, if we like spring flowers, this is the time as well to order or to go and collect your tulips, mm-hmm. your daffodils from the garden store, yep. and so you can more or less plan when you're going to plant, certainly before Halloween, certainly before the soil freezes. Mm-hmm. So by October, you make sure that mid-October, you should have planted your daffodils, your tulips. Yep. So to make sure that everything is set. Again, if you want to start wildflowers, mm-hmm. natural from the British Columbia wildflowers, we will plant at the same time in mid-October. So when the cold season arrives, everything is planted, everything is ready for the spring. When the spring arrives, everything will germinate. And there we have flowers early in the spring. So now it's as well, go and collect or order your tulips if mm-hmm. you have a variety that is not easy to find in the shops.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, that's a real reminder to me, because every year I think I start seeing them coming up in the springtime, and I think, oh man, I should have. Right?
Yes, I should have ordered, I should have planted.
Yeah.
So what we do, of course, you can do as well in pots in early spring. Take your daffodils, put in a pot, and you will have some beautiful flowers by May. But in this spring we are so busy with other things, keeping the garden. The flowers, which are beautiful and ornamental, are put aside. So,
right.
Yeah. So, for instance, as well, I work with the schools, and we make sure that all the daffodils are placed early in the fall. So, for spring, we know where. We don't have to walk, and the area where we have beautiful flowers.
And that's something you've talked about before with a lot of gardening tasks, is take advantage of the time when things are quieter to get some work done, and then, you know, you get ahead on things, and when things busy, you can focus on what needs immediate attention and not things like cleaning the garden or planting flowers that you could have planted in the fall. And
mm-hmm. So because we gardeners are busy in the spring, all indoor seeding.
Mm-hmm.
Indoor seeding and making sure that we time right when we have to move those seedlings out into the garden.
Yeah.
So that's the very busy season, early spring. But now we're just harvesting, winding down, kind of finding a space to plan, to think, and start organizing our fall and winter garden, which are is all green vegetables, few and root vegetables,
mm-hmm.
and for the winter we have all vegetables that stand the cold weather, particularly all the cabbage family and root vegetables that will be for winter.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yes, and besides that, I think this week we've been talking about the solstice happening in Europe, and we feel sad that we cannot.
The eclipse.
It's happening in Europe, and we cannot see over here. But again, we came as a gardener as well. We tried to keep with the moon cycle. Mm-hmm. I think a few weeks back we talked about gardening following the moon cycle.
Yeah,
and it's interesting because here in Canada, in British Columbia, we have each full moon has a name,
mm-hmm.
and the full moon for the August is, the name for the full moon in August is, according to the Saanich people, is called the Coho Salmon Returns. So it's very much related to the salmon, the mm-hmm. return of the salmon that's happening since the beginning of May, when the salmon slowly is making its way back to the spawning grounds, and then of course local nations use what nature provides to be able to name the moon. And if you hold in the Haida Nation, it is August is the time to go and harvest cedar bark mm-hmm. for making hats and baskets. So it's interesting. So there are international names for each full moon, but as well there is local names based on cultural traditions and as well what nature is doing.
Yeah, it's very interesting because you've got a thing here with a few different nations represented, all very tied to the annual cycle, but also very local.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Saanich are very much around things related to the sea, so it's fish and other things. You know, other groups are more about the birds and that are coming. You know, the birth moon, which is when all the animals are giving birth, and
yes,
very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
So yeah, that's something that I have prepared. So it's for instance September. here the Sandwich people call the dog salmon returns. I think the dog salmon is another type of salmon, but it's not a coho. Yeah, that is. Then October is the first frost leaves turn white, so again. November is called the winds and falling leaves, and December is the elder moon.
And January is the child moon, so obviously, you know, the elder moon, we get to the winter solstice, and there's a transition from the elder to the child moon.
To the child moon, that's a good, that's right. Yeah. because in January, leaves are becoming bigger, and we gardeners are looking forward to going into the season. And if you're a gardener, you will notice that January is very tricky. Nice, clear skies, sunny days. Lovely weather, and we suddenly get tricked, like you go to the garden and start planting seeds. And then February arrives, and we have mid-February always the snow here in Bonneville Mountain. And I was like, so all my efforts gone. So if you are interested in learning a bit more or learning what nature is saying to us, so the moon is one of the things that we can use for that.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Pablo, for coming and sharing again this week.
Nice to be here. Nice to talk and share some of the things that's happening in our garden and how we can continue as a gardener developing our connection with nature.
Excellent. Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability. How do people find out a bit more about Embark?
Yeah, so you can visit our website at embarksustainability.org or visit our social channels at Embark Sustainability. We are a learning hub, so we provide all the tools and support for our listeners or our members to develop their sustainability journeys. And in some cases, so they start the journey in gardening. And you can visit our website and social media channels and learn a bit more about us. We will be, as all the groups will be in this first or second week of September. They will be in Clubs Day in the AQ. So pass by, visit us, chat with us. We will have our booth in there.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Pablo. We'll see you next week.
See you next week.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Across the U.S., millions of people live in affordable housing, and many struggle to make ends meet. And as the climate warms, they're increasingly exposed to extreme heat.
And sometimes have to make a decision between putting food on the table or turning on the AC to a temperature that is actually safe for people to be able to withstand the extreme heat that we're seeing.
In a recent report, Juan de Clet Barreto and his team at the Union of Concerned Scientists analyzed nearly 8 million affordable housing units across the U.S. They found that almost half are in counties that received at least 21 days of extreme heat alerts from the National Weather Service in 2024.
Many of these homes are already homes that are energy inefficient, that do not have air conditioning units, or the folks that live there do not have the ability to easily pay for the bill.
Without adequate cooling, vulnerable groups, including children and the elderly, are at greater risk of heat-related illness and death. So DeClet Barreto's team recommends policies that tackle affordability and extreme heat together. For example, ensuring that low-income people can access weatherization and energy bill assistance to help vulnerable people stay safe as temperatures rise. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Something curious, something cultural, something unserious, sometimes serious, something mundane, something everyday, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday, you heard that right, Monday, from 3 to 4 p.m., your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.
Peter Arch is here now. What are you going to be talking with us about this week, Peter?
Well, last week I made a few comments about Danny, I think, did a report that we had on last week about British Columbian forest fires.
Yeah, but the work about some research folks were doing into mitigating the impact of forest fires. Yeah, we had a good discussion about that.
And then I looked on the internet in between time on my tablet, and I found out until the 1960s, actually in some reports, early 70s, that people were drafted into fighting forest fires in British Columbia.
Yeah, you were talking about how the civilians would basically be press ganged into helping the forest fire effort, you know, on the front lines.
I was a bit surprised it was that late, actually, with such a practice. I wanted to get a bit more information. One report I had in 1949, somebody was the best man at a wedding, and they were pressed gang into fighting a forest fire, and they had to postpone the wedding for a while. So it was sort of... there's a 1927 silent comedy short called Duck Soup, not to be confused with the 1933 Marx Brother Duck Soup.
Oh, so a different one.
So it's these two characters are sort of vagrants. And, of course, it takes place in Southern California because that's where it was shot.
Yeah.
And this militarist, he looks like he's in the army. You know, he's got the Smokey the Bear hat and all this. And he's anybody who is a vagrant is basically drafted in to fight a forest fire.
Yeah.
And they do something to get out of it. And at the end, they get caught and they're stuck doing it. So that was the late 1920s. The actual phrase, a press ganging, I thought there was a bit of an... Had you heard that phrase before?
I had, but mostly in relation to, you know, how the Royal Navy, the British Royal Navy...
Yeah, that's what I sort of...
Did some of its recruiting, which was they'd sort of send some folks out to some of the... rougher areas of towns and ports and press gang people to serve on the Royal Navy ships.
Well, the other thing is that somebody wrote a book that was sort of partly not apologizing for the practice.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't, I don't know, they're not quite on the, I mean, when you do stuff like that, you kind of wonder about things. The other thing that the British Navy did was they would seize vast quantities of Spanish gold and silver. In fact, that's why some of these coinage were smashed down to be converted into the... In fact, it wasn't always because of some war or conflict. It was sort of state-sanctioned piracy. Before the Royal Navy grew into a dominant global superpower, Queen Elizabeth I relied heavily on privateers, civilian mariners authorized by the government through way of letters of reprisal to attack Spanish shipping. And it's like they got a real history. Anyway.
Yeah, and they would attack Spanish ships and they'd get to keep much of the booty. The treasure or whatever they were able to recover from them.
No, interesting. I did this, it must be 2 years ago. I was talking about the American Revolutionary period. Mm-hmm. Now, George Washington, just a bit after their 1776, when they haven't won anything, they just wrote the Constitution, whatever it was. He wanted there to be a drafting. Of people. That would have been a form of press gang, wouldn't it? If you would have just... Okay, you haven't even won the war, and then you're getting all these people to be part of something you haven't won yet. But he was turned down by Congress that existed before they had a country yet, and they said no. But the... here's an interesting one. You know about the comic strip Buck Rogers in the 25th century, right?
Yep.
So... they had that started in 1929, and it went to 1967 where it was discontinued. And then when popular Star Wars, they had the TV show, and then they brought back the comic strip for a while.
Yeah, I remember.
But the original context when it started in 1929 was that he is in suspended animation for 500 years.
Right.
He wakes up to an American continent that has been taken over by the Chinese. To completely, I know it's a very racist format because it's kind of holds a bit of hysteria to it.
Yeah.
That.
I was just thinking that part of the story didn't. I didn't really pick up on that in most of the interpretations I've seen in it, but most of them are more recent. I know there were those, you know, serial shorts that would have aired in theaters for years and years and years.
That might have had that part in it. No, it didn't. So I had it's a big giant book. It has a lot of, it came out in 1969 and I acquired it in the early 70s. It has a lot of the old comic strips in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what it is that he wakes up in this world. He is of course Caucasian, and the Orientals have taken over the North American continent. But what's sort of interesting is that if you're Caucasian, you get drafted into the renegade forces.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can't sort of say, "Oh, can I fight these people on my own?" No, they have their own type of army,
right?
And you're sort of not. Like, well, what if I just surrender? Well, you can't really do that either. That's their premise for doing what they were doing. One thing I found out recently was that the prisoners of war. With the Soviet army, they were taken prisoners of war and they were killed when they came back because Joseph Stalin felt that you shouldn't have been taken prisoner of war.
Mm-hmm.
And you shouldn't have allowed that to happen to yourself.
Well, a lot of them were sent out to like camps in Siberia, partly because they were worried that they were too influenced by...
Oh.
Even though they were in... very poorly treated in German prisoner of war camps, but too influenced by Western ideas and stuff.
So, interestingly, this person, he sort of wrote a book, because some people kind of think it was okay that the British Navy acted in this way, that they have some sort of rationale why that was needed, or how do you feel about that? Do you think they should have been doing such things, Magnus?
Well, clearly not. I mean, I don't know how normal that kind of thing was for the times, but you can imagine you're just, you know, living your life, hanging out, and you get tackled and hustled off by some toughs, and next thing you know, you're on a ship sailing away from the port, and everyone you know, it doesn't exactly sound very respectful of that individual's rights.
Well, maybe they weren't that concerned about it.
I imagine not. And not to mention also that, you know, life aboard a military ship, sailing ship, was not exactly... I mean, I've read accounts of it. It doesn't sound that much different.
Oh, you've read accounts of this?
Yeah. You know, it doesn't sound that different from being in prison. You know, you're on a rigid schedule. You got to do what you got to do. If you step out of line, you get the lashes.
No. Actually, one thing I noticed on Wikipedia were saying some American slaves... chose that over. It was one notch above, though, so I guess
yeah.
You're not doing all that well if that's... there was actually one of the recent installments of the Canadian Philosophy Show was talking of... It had the phrase toxic virtue, and what they were talking about is how, like, aspect was how British imperialism had these people that it was very virtuous, and they called it kind of a toxic virtue because these things were seen as okay. So I don't think it's that okay. But I don't know. I mean, it's even... This is interesting. Mm-hmm. That British Columbia, either 1960s or early 70s, that's a bit draconian. How do you feel about that, being forced to fight a forest fire? Or?
Well, it is pretty draconian. And I guess, you know, the logic behind it was that this is an emergency and we need, you know...
19 and older.
People to fight these fires. But, you know, fighting fires is not exactly a non-skill job, and it's dangerous work, you know. And so it does seem sort of wild to scoop people up and say, we need you to work.
Didn't California had some prison people doing forest fire fighting?
Yeah, I've heard about that. They actually have, nowadays, of course, they get a lot of training. And
if you're a prisoner, we'll train you specific training
to be a firefighter. Although, this, I've heard about this years ago, and there's like a terrible catch-22 where when you're a prisoner, and you can go out and help fight the fires, and you get all this great training and build all these skills in this important role. But then when you get out, you don't qualify for those positions as a paid individual because of your record as a felon.
Yes, so.
Which is just, again, sort of seems crazy. I mean, you know, you would think that, you know, if... what rehabilitation is the thing that we're hoping to achieve with people who end up in prisons, that training them up to do this really important job and then not letting them do it on the outside seems very counterproductive.
Oh, and then the National Post, this was a few years ago, it's on the internet.
Yeah.
They contend you can still be drafted in here in British Columbia. It's part of the Wildfire Act, they were saying. But I think that's being a bit hysterical.
Well, I guess it's whether, you know, perhaps the law's is now on the books. I doubt.
It's still on the books, according to them.
Yeah, but I guess they haven't used it for years. And, you know, it seems, you know, part of the problem, of course, if you draft someone and then they get hurt during this work, you know, then you're going to you force them to do dangerous work and they get injured, that's going to end up as a legal issue. People, you know, suing or whatever. So,
well, the thing that I think they're saying, this may have probably happened during the time that your employer would have to pay for you. That was during the era when they were doing it. Your employer would have to pay for your forest fighting. That mm-hmm. your employer was drafted into it.
So you'd be drafted to you'd be drafted to dig ditches and do other firefighting work, and your regular employer would be drafted still paying your wages.
And then you're being paid for doing that, I guess. Or what?
Well, an interesting bit of BC history with a sideline into the Royal Navy and Pirates.
Yes. Okay. Until next time.
All right. See you next week.